Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Happy Monday, everybody. With the Supreme Court set to take up two cases involving same-sex marriage, that issue is on many minds here in Michigan and across the nation. On today's show, we head up north, where a Native American tribe became one of the first in the nation to legalize same-sex marriage. And a unique exhibition of prisoner art reflects life for those artists in prison and once they reenter society. But first, it seems there's a fair degree of attention paid to the question of trust, as in, how much do citizens trust their elected officials? We've certainly seen citizen trust in the federal government drop dramatically. And surveys find that while citizens tend to trust state government more than the federal government, and their local government even more than federal and state, those trust levels, citizen to government, tend to be low. But let's turn the table. Let's ask another question. Let's ask the reverse. How much do elected officials trust us, the citizens? Trust is a two-way street, and yet this question gets virtually no attention, which is why the University of Michigan's Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy, CLOSUP, decided to put that very question to local government leaders in its recent Michigan Public Policy Survey. It's a very interesting snapshot of the state of trust between us and the people we've elected as our leaders. Tom Evacco from CLOSUP joins us in the studio. Welcome back to Stateside, Tom.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me back.
Well, so before we get the verdict of the survey, let me ask, was there something that prompted you to want to look at that reverse direction of trust, as in officials towards us? Why is that so important?
Yeah, a few reasons. As you point out, there's been a lot of focus on citizen trust in government. There's been a long-term decline in that. It was relatively high back in the 1950s and 60s, and it's been a long-term decline since the 1960s. There's an awful lot of research on what that means, what the implications are, and so on. There's been very little focus on the opposite side of it. And
that's
as
true.
You say, trust really is a two-way street. And so at the same time, there's a lot of focus these days on how to increase citizen engagement in government. So we thought it's time to take a look at the opposite side and see what's happening from the inside out.
So what'd you find? How'd we do?
Well, a lot of things and a number of things that really surprised us. The first thing that we found is that local government leaders in Michigan are more likely to trust their citizens than the opposite, than their citizens are to trust them.
Very interesting.
Yeah, so we tie into a State of the State survey, which is a public opinion survey conducted by Michigan State University. And in their most recent survey, they found 35% of Michigan's Michigan citizens trust their local government to do the right thing nearly always or most of the time. So 35% from citizens to government. What we found looking the other way is 53% of Michigan's local leaders trust their citizens to be responsible participants in governance most of the time or always.
So that is lopsided.
It is, yeah. Much more trust from local leaders towards their citizens.
But I have to wonder, 53%, is it just me or does that seem kind of like a C grade? Like, kind of okay? Could it be better?
It certainly could be better. I think you're right. It feels kind of like a C. But when we compare it to the citizen level of trust,
which is kind of failing, isn't it?
This long-term decline.
Yeah.
This looks pretty encouraging.
But I guess, how does that pay off then in the terms of the kind of government that we get and give, you know, this back and forth thing? How does it pay off having that sense that at least 53% of our local leaders trust that we are, you know, nearly always or most of the time informed and engaged?
Well, again, there's been a real lack of focus on this opposite side of the trust equation. But one of the few studies out there, academic studies on government trust in their citizens, found that when local government leaders have higher levels of trust in their citizens, they're more likely to try to foster civic engagement. They're more likely to value the opinions of citizens in terms of policy options. They take local citizen opinion more seriously in identifying a variety of options for different policies and so on.
As opposed to perhaps thinking, oh, there's that crackpot complainer again at city council meeting, just fill in the blank.
Exactly.
Because I would suspect that would, if the mayor or the city council members are of any town, have a sense of you, the citizen, is that crackpot, then really you can talk all you want and you're not really going to make that impact that you hope you do.
That's exactly right.
I'm kind of interested in what it is that that we citizens need to do to convince them that we are nearly always or most of the time? Like, what is it? What kind of behaviors make them go, yeah, they're in the game?
We looked at a wide range of issues on this question exactly. And we found some differences in levels of trust by these local leaders towards their citizens that didn't make much sense to us. There are some differences by jurisdiction type. It turns out that male local leaders are more trusting of their citizens than female local leaders. We don't quite understand why. There are some things that make a little bit more sense. And so what we found is that when citizens are very engaged in their communities, local leaders trust them more. So 80% of local leaders have high levels of trust when they think their citizens are very engaged. Only 27% feel that way when their citizens are not at all engaged. When citizens are willing to take the time to become well-informed on local policy issues, local leaders trust them more. When citizens are looking for solutions instead of just complaining about problems, local leaders trust them more. And particularly important, when local leaders think that their citizens are kind of in it for the benefit of the community overall, as opposed to in it for themselves,
okay,
they trust them more.
So you can kind of pretty easily connect the dots with the kind of behavior that leads to that trust, so that when there is a city council meeting, there's not just three people sitting out there, that you have a fairly good crowd of people that are listening who do have something to say, but it, as you say, it's about the good of the community.
Yes.
And well thought out.
Yes, exactly.
So the takeaway for us with this study, what do you think, Tom?
Well, I think there's some good news in here, but there's also some warning signs. One other big difference that we found in levels of trust is whether the political discourse in the community is constructive or divisive. And in communities where the public discourse is really positive and constructive, leaders trust their citizens more. Where it's really divisive and people are fighting with each other, there's much less trust. And so that's, I think, kind of a warning sign for all of us. You know, as we've seen the political discourse in Washington and in Lansing to some extent really divide sharply on partisan lines and get pretty nasty at times. If that filters down to the local level, I think, one of the results there is going to be a less trusting environment, and that's going to come back to harm all of us.
That's kind of an erosion of what it's all about.
That's right.
Thanks for joining us today, Tom. Tom Ivacco is with the University of Michigan Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy.
Thank you, Cindy.
A national debate over same-sex marriage is certainly underway. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to weigh in on the issue this summer. A Native American tribe in northern Michigan has become one of the first in the nation to legalize same-sex marriage. Michigan Radio's Emily Fox reports from Harbor Springs.
So I guess I'm ready to sign the statute.
The tribal chairman of the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians signed a statute Friday to legalize same-sex marriage. Just moments after Chairman Dexter McNamara gave the final swipe of his pen, he married two men from Boyne City.
You are now pronounced married.
I love you.
After the exchange of vows, a more traditional Native American marriage ceremony took place. A tree branch in the shape of a hoop was placed in front of the newlyweds. The couple then tied the four medicines recognized by the tribe onto the hoop. Tobacco, cedar, sage, and sweetgrass were tied on to represent the four directions, east, south, west, and north. It also represents the four stages of life. Fred Harrington is a member of the tribe who led the ceremony.
So they have the circle of life that then it's a physical manifestation of the oath that they took for each other. They put up on the wall, and every day they can look at that and say, this is us.
Tim LaCroix and Gene Barfield have been together for 30 years and were the first to be legally married in the state of Michigan. LaCroix is a member of the Odawa tribe.
I'm so proud of my tribe for doing this for Gene and I. It just means a lot. But not only for Gene and I, but it's for all tribal members and for Native Americans in Michigan and elsewhere.
LaCroix's new husband is not a member of the Little Traverse Bay Band, but Barfield will be able to get some tribal spousal benefits, such as employment benefits. However, the marriage will not be recognized by the state of Michigan. The same-sex marriage statute within the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians has been a year in the making. It was first introduced by two women in the tribe who consider themselves what ethnographers would call two-spirit. That's someone who possesses both male and female qualities. And these people, what we would call gay, lesbian, or transgender today, were highly respected by indigenous tribes across the U.S. Denise Petoskey is a descendant of the family for which the neighboring city of Petoskey is named. She was one of the women who asked the tribal council last year to amend the marriage statute.
We have a unique opportunity here to be inclusive, and, you know, our sovereignty allows us to have equal rights. And I thought if we could do it on a small scale in this community, then, you know, it's kind of a template for other, you know, tribal nations and states to go the same route.
Last July, the tribal council failed to pass the same-sex marriage amendment by one vote. But one council member said she would support the legislation if it had language that required at least one of the partners be a tribal member. Once that language was changed, the measure was passed and Chairman Dexter McNamara signed the statute. But not everyone is behind this statute. Mel Kiogama is the legislative leader of the tribal council and voted against the statute.
My impression is the general feeling is that if this were to be put to a vote of our tribal citizens, that this would not pass.
But Chairman McNamara thinks that mindset will begin to change as the conversations about same-sex marriage continue at the state and national level.
I think there's going to be some changes down the road real soon. And I think with this putting out from the first tribe in the state of Michigan, there's going to be others to follow. I really believe that.
And that seems to be happening already. Just last week, the Tribal Council for the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi passed similar same-sex marriage legislation. Reporting in Harbor Springs, I'm Emily Fox, Michigan Radio News.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was November 2005 when the Kalamazoo Promise began, a promise that's proving to be one of the most groundbreaking, significant developments in education in our state. The Kalamazoo Promise is funded by an anonymous donor or donors. It's for graduates of Kalamazoo Public Schools as long as they have enrolled in the district by ninth grade and attend through high school and live in the district during that time. Students who qualify get 4 years of tuition at Michigan's public colleges and universities. So more than 7 years since it began, how has the Kalamazoo Promise impacted student grades, behavior, and the image of Kalamazoo's public schools? Political scientist Michelle Miller Adams is a professor at Grand Valley State University and a research fellow at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, and she joins us now from Kalamazoo. Welcome, Michelle.
Glad to be here.
Well, there is so much to celebrate about the very idea and the very design of the Kalamazoo Promise, and not knowing who the donor is adds that kind of element of intrigue. But we want to dive in now and discover what kind of difference you found that it's making right in the classrooms with the kids, because after more than 7 years, you've got enough that's happened to measure and to study. So let's start with academic achievement. What has it actually meant for the kids in terms of their achievement?
This is a really great time to be asking this question because we have just had some recent, really interesting achievement data come out. We've been waiting for it because, to be honest, the first few years, kids were really pretty much kind of set in their ways academically. It's a hard thing to recognize, but early grades, early achievement, reading on grade level by third grade, by sixth grade, has a very strong predictive effect for how you're going to be doing later on. So shifting students off that course or toward a better course is very, very hard to do late in their academic careers.
Mm-hmm.
We've been waiting for this positive news, and now 6-7 years out, we're starting to get some. So just in the past few months, we have seen some new data on graduation rates moving up quite significantly in Kalamazoo high school graduation. We have some very good data about students' likelihood of going to college, staying in college, and completing a degree in college. And the Kalamazoo Promise students are outpacing the national average pretty dramatically on that front. And then just quite recently, we have had our local newspaper do a really great analysis of MEEP scores, of our standardized test scores, and there have been quite dramatic gains across all segments of the student body, across different races, different income groups, and different achievement sectors in how they're doing on the MEEP. So as I said, it's a perfect time to ask that question. We're seeing some really positive developments in the school setting.
And what about behavioral improvements? I suppose if grades and test scores are getting better, then people must be kind of buckling down and working harder.
Well, one hopes so, and that's probably true. We're an urban district with 70% low-income students, and a lot of kids with a lot of issues in their lives bring a lot of behavior to school, so it's not perfect. But I would like to mention a really wonderful study done by my colleagues at the Upjohn Institute, Tim Bartik and Marta Lachowska, and this was quite a rigorous, they are economists, they did a difference-to-difference regression analysis, and they looked at issues they looked at a number of issues, including a number of days suspended. And this was a population at the very beginning of the Kalamazoo Promise, where they did see a reduction in the number of days suspended for those students who were eligible for the Kalamazoo Promise relative to a similar group of students who were not eligible. So that is one piece of hard data and in a good comparative study with a good control group that suggests that Kalamazoo Promise students are working on their behavior as well as their academic attainment.
I'm speaking with Michelle Miller Adams, a political scientist and a research fellow at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, looking at statistics and studies on the impact of the Kalamazoo Promise. And I'm kind of interested in, now that it appears that the Kalamazoo Promise, Michelle, is indeed bearing fruit and showing measurable positive results, is it worth it for other communities to try and create similar programs? Are there ones similar to the Promise in other districts in Michigan already?
There are. There are more than 30 Promise-type programs in place around the nation, and they show up in really every kind of community. There's one in Pittsburgh, and there's a quite long-established one in this very small town in Arkansas called El Dorado. So many, many communities, and there are quite a few in Michigan, many communities have used the Kalamazoo Promise as inspiration to create similar programs for their own communities. All of these programs look a little different from each other, but one thing that I did want to mention is that in Michigan, part of the legacy of Governor Granholm's time in office is that we have 10 Michigan Promise zones that were created in communities that are home to a higher than average proportion of low-income young people. Mm-hmm. And there are 10 of these communities, and I think about 6 of them are currently granting scholarships. These are in places like Pontiac, Benton Harbor, Saginaw, Baldwin, Michigan, a very small town north of Grand Rapids. There's a whole list of them. And again, those programs all look a little bit different from each other, but it is a population of programs that were created by the state legislature. They do involve some component of public funding, and they don't look exactly like the Kalamazoo Promise. They certainly don't have those very wealthy anonymous donors behind the program, and they're not quite as generous, but they are an important addition to this area of college access and affordability for low-income kids in Michigan.
What has the Kalamazoo Promise, Michelle, meant in terms of the higher education paths that the kids are taking? You're saying you find more kids are staying in Michigan?
Absolutely. So there has been a shifting in where students are going to college kind of all along the continuum of achievement. So we have students who never would have even considered going to college and maybe don't really have the grades or the academic experience to go to college, but they are giving it a try at our local community college. And one of the wonderful things about the Promise is that it will cover all of those career and technical training programs, from very short-term welder's emergency certificate to auto mechanic to home health care. Any of those programs that are offered mm-hmm. by the state's community colleges are covered by the Kalamazoo Promise. And then we have students who historically were going to the community college for financial reasons and then transferring to a four-year school. And they now, of course, have the opportunity to go directly to that four-year school. We have students who now have the resources to be able to go away to college, not need to live at home. And then a colleague and I recently took a look at some data from our most talented math and science students who attend our Kalamazoo Area Math and Science Center, and there is a dramatic shift among those students who previously were relatively likely to attend out-of-state universities or private colleges or universities, who have shifted strongly in the direction of in-state public institutions, particularly University of Michigan, Michigan State, Michigan Tech.
And so the significance for Michigan's workforce is?
It's important for Michigan's workforce because if you go to college in-state, you are more likely to remain in-state for your career. And we are a big exporter of college graduates, and we're a big exporter of college attenders as well. So keeping more of those, particularly advanced math and science students in state, is going to be positive for our workforce down the road. And in fact, keeping more of our students in state is positive for our workforce.
Michelle, what would you say the lessons of the Kalamazoo Promise are for other communities, especially ones who don't have that Secret Santa donor? What can they take from this program to apply to their students?
That's actually an easy question to answer, because even with our very, very wealthy group of anonymous donors, it is clear that the money only takes you so far. There are a lot of barriers that students face in going on to higher ed and being successful once they get there, and the financial barrier is just one part of that. And when you take that barrier down, you have to start grappling with all of those other issues. So a successful Promise program takes two pieces. It takes funding, but it also takes what I like to call community alignment, where the school district, the organizations that support students, the broader community, the business community, all align their work in support of higher education access and attainment and support students along that developmental pathway so they're ready for school, they're successful in school, they are on track to graduate and go on to some kind of post-secondary education, and then be able to enter the workforce with a family-sustaining wage. So I think that piece of community alignment is really critical to think about, and you can think about that even in the absence of dollars.
And, yeah, if everybody's upping their game, then I have to only imagine that the image of the public school system in Kalamazoo has been improved, too, because everybody, it sounds as if, for, you know, teachers are seeing their students go off to college. That makes everybody up their game. Even kids who don't qualify for the Promise, I would imagine if they're in classrooms where everybody's just kind of pushing harder, it's going to bring everybody along.
Absolutely. That peer effect is really important. So even if you don't qualify for the Promise, if everyone around you is going to college, the odds are good you're going to be thinking about that too. I did a recent quick study of how the local newspaper had presented the public schools before and after the Promise, and we saw a really, again, dramatic shift in both the amount of coverage and the tone of the coverage in a much more positive direction. And, of course, what you read in the paper about your local school district is going to shape perceptions of that district. And perceptions do matter. Image does matter, and it creates kind of a virtuous circle where more people are feeling good about the public schools, supporting the public schools, and it kind of feeds on itself in a really positive direction.
An absolutely fascinating and I'm dare I say inspiring social and educational experiment, the Kalamazoo Promise. Michelle, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today on Stateside.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Political scientist Michelle Miller Adams is a professor at Grand Valley State University and a research fellow at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, and she joined us today from Kalamazoo. Ever since man first set foot on the moon in 1969, the question has been, what's next? And the logical answer would be Mars. In fact, for the past 7 months, NASA's spunky little rover Curiosity has been prowling around the Gale crater on Mars, sending back tantalizing pieces of information, stoking the fires of curiosity about the prospect of life on Mars. The newest report is an analysis of a rock sample collected by Curiosity that shows, yes, indeed, ancient Mars could have supported living microbes. Well, never mind the microbes. What about the prospects for humans? And what would it take to get human beings to Mars? That's a question being worked on right now in the laboratory of Ben Longmire. He's an assistant professor of aerospace engineering at the University of Michigan. His research areas are electric propulsion, spacecraft design, and basic plasma physics. So, Ben, let's start at square one. What would it take to get humans to Mars? We got the little rover there. What now?
Sure, yeah. So we can get robots there. We can get small payloads there, about a metric ton. So, you know, the kind of the weight of a car, a small Mini Cooper or something like that, which is about the size of the Curiosity rover there right now.
Yeah.
We know how to do that. It turns out it's still pretty difficult. So you've maybe seen the landing sequence. They use this sky crane with retro rockets, and they lower this thing down on a pulley system, and it, you know, lands the rover, and then the thing disconnects, and it flies away. Before that sequence, they had this big heat shield to enter the very thin Martian atmosphere. But it turns out that whole sequence is sort of capped out at about 2 tons. So they've landed 1 ton. They could maybe double it. But going beyond that sort of mass, it's very difficult to land anything bigger than that on the surface of Mars right now. We don't really know how to do it.
Okay, so we are not at a place where, given enough money, we could go ahead and send a manned mission there.
Yeah, that's right. Well, maybe. Researchers are very good at figuring out how to do something, right? So that's my job. That's the job of a large number of researchers around the country, NASA included. And, you know, given some money, they're very good at attacking these sorts of problems. But to date, we haven't had the funding and sort of the base level, maybe public support, to go do a mission like this. It's expensive. It's hard to do. It takes many years. And so some of the biggest challenges of doing this are actually political. How do you, in a 4 or 8 year system, how do you get sustained funding for 20 years, right?
So it sounds like the answer might not be in the government. The answer might be in private business.
It could be. It could very well be.
We're speaking with Professor of Aerospace Engineering at University of Michigan, Ben Longmire, who is working in the areas of electric propulsion and spacecraft design and asking what would it take to get humans to Mars. Now, would we have to have a different kind of propulsion system or a different kind of spacecraft than we've seen, let's say, with the Apollo missions?
Right, yeah. So the Apollo used chemical fuel. Mm-hmm. You burn that chemical fuel just like the space shuttle and the Saturn V and all that stuff. It turns out you can go to the moon with that, no problem. We've done that, obviously. Mm-hmm. We know how to do that. That technology is about 100 years old, maybe older, and it has a pretty good performance, pretty good. But it's not quite good enough to do it in a really efficient way for going to Mars. So, for example, if we wanted to go to Mars today, mm-hmm. we want to land people down on the surface of Mars, walk around, mm-hmm. get those people back into their capsule and get them back.
Mm-hmm.
To do that sort of mission as cheaply or as basically as we could, you're still talking about $100 billion or more. So this exceeds the NASA budget, the NASA yearly budget, by a factor of, you know, 10 at least.
Especially now that it's
been cut. Yeah, that's right. Now that it's being cut. So,
yeah.
So that's a hard pill to swallow, right? So convincing the taxpayers and Congress that we should do this mission for this amount of money, that's difficult. That's a difficult sell. So you can get to Mars with this traditional sort of chemical mm-hmm. propulsion. That's possible. It just turns out that it's really expensive because you need to burn so much fuel to get there. And you get there relatively slowly, about 2 years or so round trip.
Okay. So are there things on the horizon that would change this 100-year-old technology and move us forward?
There absolutely are, yeah. So the lab that I work in, the Plasma Dynamics and Electric Propulsion Lab, PEPL, which was started by Alec Gallimore back in the early 90s. This lab is sort of the leader, not just in Michigan, but in the world, for developing new propulsion technologies. So we work on the full scale of propulsion in terms of power. So we work on very high power things, we work on very low power things, and sort of everything in between. We're working on now a new thruster that will be very high power. It'll be what you would need to send humans to Mars. So you could cluster a whole bunch of these large thrusters that we're working on in our lab, put them on a spacecraft, light them off, and send people and supplies to Mars more quickly than we can do that now. And more importantly,
more cheaply?
More cheaply.
Okay.
That's right.
So it could be less than 2 years.
Yeah, that's right. We think we could do it in about a year in a realistic sort of time frame round trip. And we think we could do it for a fraction of the cost as well. Given that these thrusters use their fuel much more efficiently, they use plasma instead of chemical propulsion.
Do you think there would be any shortage of people saying, nope, I want to go?
I don't think so. So I teach an aerospace propulsion class, teaching for the first time this spring. And I ask my students, I've asked them about 3 times, you know, okay, let's lay out this mission. Going to Mars, you're coming back. How many people would sign up for this trip? How many people would go? And I get maybe about a third of the class raise their hands, and some of them want to be astronauts themselves someday. And so that's about a third. And then I ask the question, what if it's a one-way trip? What if you have to stay there and live out the rest of your life on this mission? Maybe supplies show up. Maybe the thing goes bankrupt and you have to live off the land.
You're a science fiction movie.
Yeah, that's right. How many people would do that? And it turns out it's about half. So about 1/6 of my class still has their hands up.
Still has that adventurous
spirit. That's right. Yeah, that's
spirit.
Right.
Would you do it?
I don't think I would do the one-way trip. I enjoy nature, and I enjoy being outside, breathing oxygen, and, you know, freely without a suit on.
Ben Longmire is an assistant professor of aerospace engineering at the University of Michigan College of Engineering. So good luck with the first light in a couple of weeks. Thanks for talking with us, and we'll be enjoying following your process as you go through this.
Great. Thank you.
This is Stateside, and I'm Cynthia Canty. There is an art exhibition opening tomorrow that is like few others in the country. This is the 18th annual exhibition of art by Michigan prisoners. It's become nationally recognized, and through its 18 years, it's become the largest exhibition of prisoner art in the country. This year's exhibition includes more than 300 works of art by more than 200 artists. It'll run from tomorrow, March 19th, until April 3rd at the Duderstadt Center Gallery on the North Campus of the University of Michigan. And anyone who views these works of art will be startled, moved, and certainly impressed. Joining me today in the studio is the founder of the Prison Creative Arts Project, PCAP, Buzz Alexander, who's also a professor of English at U of M. Welcome, Buzz.
Thank you.
Very good to have you with us. And Brent Barth is with us. He's a watercolor artist, a former prisoner, and he is someone who is now part of PCAP's Linkage Project, which is aimed at connecting the artist with mentors and exhibitions once they return to society. In other words, keep the art flowing. Brent, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, Buzz, take us back, if you will, to the very beginning of the Prison Creative Arts Project, and what was it that led you to found this program?
I had participated in a very small exhibition with women, and so I knew about that. But when Jenny Paul moved into my house and became my partner, we sent out a letter to all of the facilities within a 120-mile radius of Ann Arbor, and there were a lot of prisons at that time, 20 prisons. And what we discovered was that there were already great artists working in the Michigan prisons.
So the idea of going in and offering all of these forms of self-expression, the goal is what?
We go to all of the sites. Mm-hmm. This year we went to 28 prisons. There's only one prison where we didn't get to because it's way over on the Wisconsin border. Mm-hmm. And when we come in, we are in awe. We bring respect to the artists. And this year there are 428 works of art in the show. And what this means to the artists, when we come in, they prepare all year for this. They start working on it, and when they come in, they're very excited about us coming. What happens for them is that they, because of the exhibition, they gain visibility. One of the artists talked about how it's a bridge between her and the community. Mm-hmm. There are several artists who've told us that they have not committed suicide because of the art show. Some artists realize that they get a kind of forgiveness, and it's not forgiveness for their crime.
Sure.
But when people come in and work with him, he re-enters the world. The students come in, and he's also been in the art show for many years. He's now home. And he says that gives him a kind of forgiveness, a kind of reconnection to the world.
And Brent Barth, watercolor artist, give us your story. So start by telling us why you were in prison and when.
I was in prison because of an accident that occurred May 7th in 2007, I had been at a golf outing with friends and was drinking. And when I left the golf outing and was headed towards home, I ran over a motorcycle. And in the process of doing that, I ended up going to prison for the crime. It was OWI causing serious injury. Mm-hmm. The people today are, I believe, okay, but I've never had contact with them. Several people have told me never to have contact with them again, and I guess the biggest thing in my life that makes that so difficult is that's not Brent Barth, and mm-hmm. it's something that I'll have to live with the rest of my life. But I will tell you this, that since May 7, 2007, I haven't had a drink since.
And how long were you in prison? Where were you incarcerated and how long?
I was incarcerated in the Michigan Correctional Facility. Mm-hmm. I was in Saginaw for basically all of my term. I was there for 40 months.
Okay. And how did this art project come to you? How did you hear about it, and what were your thoughts when you heard about it?
When I started out in prison, I didn't really know about the art project. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of amazing how it worked for me is I was in the yard one day. And if you've ever been to a prison yard, the prisoners take care of the flowers and they take care of the gardens. And there's a lot of beautiful, beautiful flowers and trees. And it's just because that's what we have to take care of. That's what we find our time doing when we have free time in the yard. And I was out painting in the yard, and a fella had approached me, Larry, had approached me and another prisoner, mm-hmm. and asked me if I would take the time to teach him how to paint. And so upon that, I says, yeah, Larry, meet me out here tomorrow. I'll be here doing the same thing. Have a nice day. And the next thing you know, he didn't show up, and I didn't see him for a few days. And I received a letter back from the Hobbycraft coordinator of Saginaw Correctional Facility, Mr. Rosick. Mr. Rosick sent me this kite back, in other words, that said that you can have the cafeteria from 6 o'clock in the evening to 9 o'clock in the evening to teach your watercolor painting class at the Saginaw Correctional Facility. So we started watercolor painting class.
Is that because the other fellow went out and said, hey, guess what? There's a guy who's going to teach us, and then the word spread?
Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. So how many students did you have when you showed up?
We had as many as 30 people come in out of a group. And we actually would have – we only had 120 men in our particular facility. So it was a place where they came. And the amazing thing is like I think Buzz had made light of this too, is the works and the art that came out of there – that showed up at the exhibit, because they would come and bring art to the exhibit. But there's another amazing thing that happened is there's a ton of this artwork that never made it there that's just as good, if not better, than the works that I've ever produced and everything else. It was just amazing to see what these prisoners could put together as art.
And what did that give you, that chance to be able to focus on your art when you were in this environment of being in a prison?
It gave me an opportunity to go places. It gave me an opportunity to see people. It gave me an opportunity to visit beaches and mountains. And those were the places that I painted a lot in my paintings, were the mountains from the Teton Mountains in Wyoming to the beaches of Florida, where I used to vacation with family all the time. And so I would revisit those places through my art. And anybody that ever had a piece of my art given to them, or anybody that ever bought a piece of work, saw where I was visiting.
Yes.
For my term when I was in prison.
And now that you're out, you're involved in what's called the Linkage Project. How does that work? Yes. What is that about?
The Linkage Project is put on by these wonderful people at the University of Michigan, Buzz Alexander mm-hmm. and Vanessa, and Heather was here before, mm-hmm. and I could give out all the list of names, and I would surely forget somebody, so I don't really want to go there. But they give you an opportunity to take your art to galleries. They give you an opportunity to go to workshops and to classes and to learn more about your art. And it's not just painting art or pencil art. Mm-hmm. It's art as far as writing and dance and all those other things that Buzz had described earlier. They give you names and places of people that you need to go see and talk to so that you can advance all these wonderful things that you learned while you're in prison when you had time to learn them.
So how much difference would you say in your life that the Prison Creative Arts Project has made? Can you even put it into words, the difference it's made in your life?
No, it's really hard to put into words. And actually, it saved my life when you really get down to the nitty-gritty of it. Even Buzz said that a lot of people say that that they don't commit suicide because they have art. They have that release. And I'm a firm believer that my whole prison the whole incident altogether, the whole me getting incarcerated and me going to jail, the whole thing as a total sum saved my life. Wow. Otherwise, I would have been drunk and dead on a roadside from a car accident. Otherwise, all things would have happened, but the art has given me that place to go and to be. Mm-hmm. When I think about maybe drinking again, the art has given me a place to be. I paint on a regular basis now all the time, especially in those times when there's a mood swing. I may go to work someday and things might not be all that cheerful or all that happy, but I know when I come home, I can put it on paper and I can take it out of me and put it somewhere else.
In a positive way.
In a positive way. And it's given me that release. I'm very thankful for that. And I don't think I've said that enough to Buzz or to Vanessa or to all the others. There's so many people in the PCAP program that need the thanks.
We're talking about the Prison Creative Arts Project, PCAP, with its founder, Buzz Alexander of the University of Michigan, and watercolor artist and former prisoner Brent Barth. And the exhibition of art by Michigan prisoners will be opening tomorrow and running through April 3rd. And I went on your website, and we're going to put a link to the PCAP website up on our website at michiganradio.org, and looked at everything that's up there. And I'll tell you, there was an astonishing array of themes, some things that were very, very gentle, very harmonious, and some things that were macabre. Mm-hmm. Do you see an evolution of themes as maybe somebody starts on the darker side and then as things get out of their system or they're able to express themselves, does the art evolve maybe into a more peaceful place, if I may use that word?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Because it depends on where one is in prison and what's happening in prison at a particular time. So somebody may begin with a nature piece or a landscape or a family portrait, and then something happens and they go into dark spaces. There's a lot of art about prisons, a lot of pieces this year. Our theme this year actually is based on the University of Michigan race theme, and our theme this year, and artists could submit for this, is understanding race. And I think there will be 30 to 40 pieces on one wall all addressing that issue.
Buzz Alexander, I know PCAP's goal in putting on these exhibitions is to inspire dialogue between the incarcerated and the community at large. What do you hope that dialogue will be?
Well, I can talk about this in two ways. Mm-hmm. The understanding race piece, actually, we're hoping that when people come into the gallery and look at that, there will be dialogues in the gallery about that. Also, what we do is we have the artists write bios, and they're all printed in a bio book. I think it may be 40 pages this year. Mm-hmm. And so when somebody looks at a work, they can go to the bio book, and that actually enhances sales because people are very honest, not about their crimes. Very few of them talk about their crimes, but they talk about themselves as artists.
Which is, I'm sure, what they really want to hang on to is that putting that face forward.
That's right. And we also have a guest book where people can write in the guest book, celebrate the artists. Maybe once every 3 years somebody says something nasty, but there are a million entries in that, and people celebrate the artists. They talk about particular artists and so on. I type that out, and we send a copy of that to every one of the prisoners. There are, I think, 231 prisoners in the show this year. And we also have a video, and the video goes to all of the facilities. We send it free, the work improves because people are isolated in a given prison, and yet they see everything that everybody else is doing, and that's one of the reasons that this show gets better and better.
Brent, as a former prisoner and someone who is working with prisoners through the Linkage Project, what would you want people who have never been inside a prison to understand about the prisoners who are creating these pieces of art?
That's a great question. And actually, the thing that people need to understand is they're just normal people. They're people just like me and you and just like Buzz. Mm-hmm. We have feelings, and they need to be treated that way. And so many people think that, oh, they're prisoners. Oh, they're convicted felons. Oh, they're bad people. And that's not the case at all. And that's what surprised me so much about prison and actually going to prison that I never knew. I never knew. Before I went to prison, I owned a couple companies. And in owning those companies, I always shied away from anybody with any sort of a criminal conviction. Mm-hmm. They didn't have to go to prison, but even somebody just on the state or local level. But when I got there, I realized, wow, these people are just like me. And all I did was make a mistake.
Okay.
Not to make light of their mistakes. A lot of people have made some really, really bad mistakes. I made a really, really bad mistake. But they're people, and they have feelings, and I think that, you know, if anything the public needs to know is they are. They're just real.
Well, the exhibition opens tomorrow, March 19th, and runs until April 3rd. It'll be at the Duderstadt Center Gallery right there on the North Campus of the University of Michigan. And we have put up a link to the PCAP website on our website at michiganradio.org. I've been talking with the founder of the Prison Creative Arts Project, Buzz Alexander, who's also a professor of English at U of M, and Brent Barth, who is a watercolor artist, a former prisoner, and is now working with prisoners to keep the art coming once they're released into society. Thank you both so much for sharing your story, and I know there's a lot of us going to be heading over and checking out that exhibition. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Independent producer and U of M professor of art Stephanie Rowden visited prisons in Michigan, and she spoke with several incarcerated artists in 2010. She prepared this audio postcard about why the artists make art and what it means to be a part of the show.
When I do my artwork, it's very, very intense. I take my time. I don't rush it. It's intense, but it's intense in a quiet way. It's like an innocence. When you draw, don't think so much when you draw. Just go.
I've been down in prison for over 48 years, so the things that you miss most in prison, the normal, everyday things, just walking up the street, it's the things that I want to be able to see, and I can't see, so I create for myself.
In here, we're not real people, we're prisoners, but we're allowed to be real people because of our art. You could paint a mountain and you can be in that mountain. You could paint friends and pictures of things that you longed for, that you wanted to be with at home, and it gives you that time to be with those people.
I work sitting on a small stool with a painting propped on the edge of my bed. So thankfully, I've got a bottom bunk. That's when I can paint. I use my footlocker to hold my paint palette, and I put a book on top of my wastebasket to hold my brush cleaner and my coffee cup and my spare brushes. And that's pretty much it. That's my studio.
I do a lot of portraits. Themes: slavery, being free, Underground Railroad, struggles. Joyful things, too. Pride. Those are my big things that I draw about.
I like to do scenes that have to do with memories of people. The streets you used to live on, maybe a cottage in the woods that you used to go to, soft, serene places. And I want people to be able to look at the art and have a nice feeling about it.
It's just something bigger than life right now, that to be finally a part of something with my art. I know a lot of people will see this.
When they say that 3,000 visitors showed up, I would assume that they may come from all over the world.
I want as many of my proceeds to go to charity as I can, because my case, I was drinking and driving, I killed a guy in a car accident, and I'm trying to give something back to the community in any way I can, as soon as I can. You know, after racking your brain for so many years, you're like, what do I do? You're like, well, this is what I can do. The money's nothing. That's nothing. You know, it's just, like I said, trying to give back something back. That's all I want to do.
My name is James Goslin.
My name is Edward Mast.
My name is Ruben Kenyatta.
Brent Barth.
Vincent Camacho.
Corey Tackett.
Maurice Lucas.